Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of many books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation Technology and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. Also, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. And most recently, Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise, and I thought we'd continue from our last podcast discussion and bring an update of what's going on with the social and economic effects of the lockdown and the virus, what's happening to the economy, the financial markets, and maybe you could set the context as you see it. You had a great posting today on your blog, entitled Depression Dominoes Are Falling. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's no surprise to those listeners who've heard a number of our programs over the years that I see the old normal, the economy, both in North America and globally, that was the normal in 2019 was actually increasingly fragile, and brittle. It was based on just continuing extremes of debt, speculation, leverage, pay to play, political corruption. I mean, it just extremes that we kind of got normalized to, but they were actually very remarkable, right? Including corporate debt and many other things, overvalued markets. So what I see is the pandemic lockdown is being blamed for destroying the economy, but actually the economy was already teetering. It was the line of dominoes of fragile extremes was already in place. And so the lockdown was simply the catalyst, and it could have been some other catalyst, but in my view, a depression was already baked in because we didn't attempt to control or limit any of these extremes that create systemic fragility. So the first domino is obviously the pandemic triggered layoffs, and it also triggered capital and trade flow disruptions, right, which have a number of effects. And most importantly, in my mind, it created a tremendous uncertainty about the future. And if we think about lending, in particular, and any kind of economic activity, like you're going to invest in some new venture or some new equipment, you're going to hire new people, whatever activity you're considering, if there's a very high level of uncertainty, then that increases the risk of making a bad decision, right, of ending up making a decision and losing money because you the uncertainty factors were just out of your control, right? And so, I think it's a cliche, but I think it's true that markets love certainty and they do not like uncertainty, right? So we now have basically uncertainty going forward as far as you can see, right? In terms of the impact of the virus, whether there'll be a vaccine, how long that will be, if the vaccine will actually be effective, or if it will lose effectiveness with time, and on and on and on. There's just an endless number of uncertainties going forward. So how is that going to affect businesses? Well, high-cost small businesses are already folding, right? People with very high fixed costs, they already can see that they're not going to survive at 50 or 60% capacity. And we also are seeing that consumers are realizing they're going into this, whatever you want to call it, recession, downturn, depression, with very little savings. You know, most of the savings are like everything else concentrated in the top 5%. So there's going to be a drag on consumer spending simply because people realize the necessity of saving. Well, what's that going to do to consumer spending? And we know that the top 5% households are responsible for about 50% of the consumer spending. A huge amount of services are, you know, dependent on the top upper middle class, right? So if that class of people starts losing income or jobs, or just sees their wealth starting to decline, then they're going to pull back on their spending just like everybody else. And so that would have an outsized effect. And then you see what happens when consumer spending falls. Well, state and local taxes plummet. So they're going to have to cut their employees, and they're going to be facing, you know, pension plan cuts and so on. And then all the lenders that are have lent money to marginal borrowers, which is probably the bottom 50% of all borrowers that are now suffering, you know, huge catastrophic losses in income or job stability, they're going to be defaulting, right? They really don't have a choice. And so what's going to happen to the lenders is the dominoes are going to fall there. And we can talk more about that later. And then my last domino was I see the safe sectors, you know, the sectors everyone thought were evergreen, permanent, would only grow forever, tech, healthcare, higher education, finance. I think all of those are really vulnerable to significant losses in revenue, profits, and in employment.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention like the changing landscape of government regulations, government rules, you know, uncertainty there, as well as in the virus itself. How long is it going to take for a vaccine? Everybody's expecting a couple of months, but generally the average time for a vaccine is 4 years. And so we're not even at 4 months yet. So this could be a long time before we get a vaccine. Uncertainty as well as how effective that vaccine will be. You know, will it be fully effective, only partially effective? Does it need to be continuously administered? Supply and distribution of that, who gets it first? There's just so much uncertainty out there.
Yeah, and we're looking at travel. I mean, just to kind of elaborate on your point about multiple layers of uncertainty, we're seeing articles that the European Union countries are leaning towards not allowing any visitors from the U.S. as the virus spreads rapidly in America. And here in Hawaii, there's the state is pursuing a plan that other tourist destinations are also doing, which is you're not allowed on the plane to visit us unless you have a negative virus test within 72 hours. Or if you decide to come anyway, there's a 14-day minimum mandatory,
quarantine.
Set aside. Yeah, quarantine. Thank you. Yeah. So, and then now the federal government is the Department of Justice is suing the state of Hawaii, claiming that that's prejudicial or to Hawaii residents. And so then, as you say about regulations, well, what's going to ultimately be the most important thing here? States' control of their borders for health reasons, or can the federal government open the state of Hawaii to a spread of the virus? You know, I mean, that would be appalling in my view. But anyways, again, how can anybody bet on any of this stuff? And it's certainly in terms of betting on a V-shaped recovery, that's getting more and more implausible with every passing day.
Yeah. And I mean, we've just had the first wave, but now there's talks of a potential second wave coming and more lockdowns. What do you think is the likelihood of that happening?
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic, Richard, because there's general frustration with being locked in down at home and frustration at the decline or collapse of the economy. But the civil authorities, they still have a responsibility to make policies to the best of their ability that are going to protect the most vulnerable populations and to limit the spread of the virus to because of, you know, for a variety of reasons. And so where is there going to be a balance? And it doesn't look like there's going to be a perfect balance. You're not going to be able to balance lockdowns, limited lockdowns, restrictions. It's there is no perfect balance here. And remember the talk a few months ago early on as an example of like irrational exuberance that the virus is going to die on its own, die back in April as temperatures warmed up. And instead, here it is summer and it's actually picking up, you know, momentum. So there's been a lot of false hopes. And so that should raise the question in our minds, what else that's common thinking now is in fact just another false hope. So in terms of just to go back to the topic of like limited activity, for instance, these quarantines and requirements to be have a negative test in hand before you travel somewhere. To me, that's common sense, right? And but a lot of people are going to balk at any restrictions, any limitations, so they're not going to go. So what level of tourism is going to arise after you go through these hoops and common sense limitations? Is it going to be 10% of what it was last year? 20%? I think anybody predicting more than that number is really veering into irrational euphoria.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there could be a second wave in the fall of the Northern Hemisphere where the cooler weather comes in and also sort of conveniently in time for locking down during the period of the U.S. presidential election to minimize political violence and civil unrest? So meaning the month of October and the month of November.
Yeah, I think that's a very plausible scenario, Richard, because history suggests, you know, that viruses pick up momentum in fall. And so we have to be a little bit wary here that this virus is picking up, you know, speed here in summer. So what's the potential for it in autumn? It's sobering. And we also have to, you know, recall that this virus, being a coronavirus and a virus of any type, is extremely, you know, prone to mutating. And there's a general assumption that every mutation that could possibly occur is going to be a positive one. In other words, it's going to become less dangerous with every mutation. But that's also not guaranteed. You know, it could not only spread because the weather changes, it could become more dangerous because of mutations. So another gigantic uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the effect going to be on municipalities? You alluded to earlier the level of debt and how strapped they are in the pension fund area. Like, where do you see that going? And effects, for example, on the property taxes going higher, making up for lost property taxes. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, Richard, you'd suggested as a topic for today the sort of de-urbanization movement, where people are either leaving or considering leaving city centers for suburbs, exurbs, rural towns, and so on. And I'd like your views on that. But if that's real, and it seems to be real at the top level, in other words, the people with the most money are the ones who are leaving first. what's that going to do to cities that are already pressured from the loss of bricks and mortar? And, you know, I've mentioned in previous programs, like the second order effects of this kind of thing. Like you can say, okay, the first order effect is the lockdown. Then people couldn't go out and go shopping. Well, now that the lockdowns are lifted, well, then people can go out shopping, but maybe not everybody's comfortable going shopping. Maybe not that many businesses have can look ahead and say, we're going to be profitable again in a few months. So they close. Well, at what point is there like a shopping district loses a critical mass, you know, where it's no longer appealing or no longer fun to go there? Then that would be a self-reinforcing feedback. And that's kind of what I'm afraid of for a lot of urban areas, that once the exodus starts gathering speed, pretty soon you've got not just a linear effect, but you can have a nonlinear effect where the loss of 10% of your bricks and mortar businesses can end up triggering a decline in consumer spending of 50%. And of course, that's all those revenues, the tax revenues did plummet, and the value of those commercial buildings would plummet, which would reduce property taxes. And so then, you know, I see that self-reinforcing feedback eventually going to zero. In other words, because if you have an empty building, it's really worth nothing. And if there's very few prospects to rent it out at rates high enough to pay the mortgage, I see like a mass wave of defaults in the commercial real estate, which would then trigger a bunch of other dominoes falling. So it looks to me like cities and counties may be forced to raise taxes at a rate of increase that's going to stagger and stun the residents, you know, because the shortfalls are going to be, even for a small city, can be in the tens of millions of dollars. And for larger cities, they can be into the hundreds of millions. And to raise that kind of revenue off of the normal taxes is going to require horrendous tax increases. And that's going to then create a self-reinforcing feedback loop to push people out of those high tax areas. And so that should give us, you know, give us pause about the solvency of municipal governments and pension plans.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be happening in waves. So the first to go seem to have been the very, very wealthy, like billionaires that have gone to like New Zealand. There was a lot of like fallout shelters, potential, you know, risk of nuclear type of radiation or attack. You know, a lot of people were buying fallout shelters. So many of them have gone there. In other places around the world, and now we're into the you know, regular wealthy or middle class, you know, layers in terms of what are they going to do? So, you mentioned several of these things that are happening. I mean, the rise in taxes, property taxes, you know, cities being all cooped up, and all these additional rules with the lockdown have made it uncomfortable to live there, you know, limited space in condominiums, and just land in general going about, getting around, have made it logistically difficult. So in addition to the property taxes, that issue, and even now like social and civil unrest, due to protests of different issues, increasing and picking up, perhaps also due to the general discontent, you know, of the lockdown, mixed in as sort of the sentiment. So, yeah, I see a fleeing out of the cities into the suburbs, into the countryside, exurbs, and it seems to be happening all over, you know, in the indebted Western world, if you will. So, by that, I mean, also, it could happen in waves. So as people begin to realize this is not just a short-term thing, initially it was touted as being just a two-week lockdown or a four-week lockdown, but it keeps getting extensions, and people seem to be understanding this as a longer-term type of lockdown or a new normal, if you will. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and it's interesting. Because you mentioned sort of the upper middle class, which will be the next wave, the people, the very wealthy have the bunkers globally, but even the below them, then people have second or third homes already, so they, you know, mm-hmm. they can go to their vacation house and make it their permanent residence. So there's that class. But what happens to the valuations of all this urban real estate as a lot of people are trying to sell and there's very few buyers because it's no longer compelling or attractive. I mean, could we see a massive reset of urban housing values, you know, set 40% lower? I mean, what would that do to property taxes? I mean, so there's that question too of a wealth drain was, I think, your terminology, which covers a lot of ground. But I would say one source of a wealth drain is the house that you in urban America that you were certain was going to be worth $1 million forever. Maybe it's only worth $500,000 because there's no, because the buyers are going to be overwhelmed by the sellers.
Mm-hmm. So where does this all go? Like, are we talking a new normal and a different type of economy away from the bricks and mortar, as you mentioned, shopping districts, commercial districts? How do you see that evolving?
Well, you know, I want to hear your thoughts on one of your topics we wanted to discuss today was the homebody economy. And of course, that's obviously, you know, you stay at home, then you can get a lot of services and goods delivered. But it also kind of fits in with the people who can work at home. And so, you know, if you have to work outside, if you're a government employee or you work for a utility or something, well, you're already out in the world, and so you might as well go shopping, right? But the class of people that can work entirely remotely, then it's going to be, and they tend to be higher income households. They are going to be even more prone to becoming shifting a lot of their economic activity to the home, including consumption. So, what are your thoughts on the homebody economy, which is a great term?
Yeah, I mean, I think initially it's being perceived, or there's a perception being promoted as work from home being positive to get everybody acclimated to this. But I think there's some dangers in that, some risks that people are not seeing yet. And it's sort of coming out slowly, where I hear talks about now of salary adjustments. So if you go to a much lower cost area, you know, much farther away from the city, then there may be a renegotiation of salary compensation to a lower value, right, to fit that that locale. So instead of getting the high paid city jobs, it would go lower. And if that was not acceptable, there could be also increased outsourcing for these jobs overseas. Which may happen anyways, depending on the job, you know, what the nature of the job is. Because if you're doing work from home, I mean, what's the difference of doing it in the country or overseas or outside of the country? So there's risks there that may happen to the overall job market that I think a lot of people are not seeing. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Richard, because you know, the high salaries that corporations have been willing to pay for managerial, you know, technocrat positions, it's been to some degree based on scarcity, right? That the people with the skills and the higher levels of education have been relatively scarce. But as the global depression starts washing over the entire world and layoffs happen in every sector, then we can also foresee, even within the developed countries, perhaps a pool of qualified people that didn't exist before. Instead of scarcity, maybe there's going to be an abundance of people with managerial and tech skills, and which would then dramatically reduce the market value of their labor. So I guess I'm just saying that we could see a reduction in salaries from the mechanisms you mentioned, and possibly in addition, just a larger pool of qualified people in the developed countries. And so, and we know there's a big wage differential between, say, the U.S. and Portugal, Spain, even Japan. You know that there could be developed countries with huge unemployment. in people with advanced degrees. And so we might see a movement where, you know, salaries are going to be cut simply because qualified people exist in lower cost countries, not to mention Eastern Europe, right? So, yeah, that seems highly likely. If you're a corporate manager and you're seeing your revenues shrink, you've got to cut your costs, and you've already done everything else on the lower level. You know, you've already outsourced your janitorial service, you know, and blown off all your other expenses. So now you're going to have to start cutting the meat, you know, that you've already cut all the fat. That was done over the last 20 years. So.
And the former chief economist of Merrill Lynch, David Rosenberg, pointed out recently that with 40 million approximately lost jobs in the U.S., unemployed additionally from this COVID crisis, and what's happened since that inception of the crisis, there could be about 25% of those 10 million permanently unemployed people that are unable to find work again. So he thinks that there could be number at that level, which could translate to a sort of UBI, universal basic income, to those 10 million. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's becoming almost accepted now as the solution everybody's going to be looking to. And, you know, I think, frankly, 10 million is fairly optimistic in my view. It could easily be 20 million people because these dynamics we've been discussing, that it's going to be really challenging to keep your business afloat. And we see the potential for a lot of zombie corporations, which are, you know, borrowing heavily right now, thanks to the Federal Reserve, to build up a bit of cash. But it doesn't mean that they're solvent. It just means they borrowed more money to pay to service their existing debt. You know, so there could be mass layoffs as corporations fold, as well as small business. So, and I think if I'm not sure what you think about this level of uncertainty. But I think psychologically, I think it there's a second wave of psychological impact too. I think what I'm seeing is there was a lot of hope on the part of the average person and consumer that it's all going to kind of like fix itself, or, you know, we got this thing behind us, and optimism. And now I think as the second wave, or wave 1.2, some people say we haven't even gotten to the second wave, right? This is simply the first wave. I think there's going to be a very strong possibility of a reversion to a much more sober perspective on the future, which would mean more impetus to save and less impetus to borrow and spend. And that, I think, is where the real damage is going to occur, you know, because if people stop being willing to borrow and spend huge sums of money, then that's going to kill off economic growth. And we don't seem to have any plan B, you know, for a degrowth economy. I mean, those of us on the margins talk about it a lot, but the status quo just doesn't have any plan B for a degrowth economy. And so that I think is part of why I see it like a chain of dominoes. But I suppose there are some bright spots here. And before we started recording, you were telling me some of the bright spots in the homebody economy.
Yeah, let's go back to that. So we have this looks like developing new normal economy, the so-called homebody economy. And, you know, what is the vision of that? So if we think of what's happening, we've got people working from home. They need internet services, telecommunications services. They need utilities, right? Electricity, natural gas. They are generally just buying food, cooking home. So, you know, less on the restaurants, but cooking home. So they need to go to food distributors, either delivering to the home or wholesale food services that are available nearby in the community. So that's what's happening there on the food. And but just in general, like the delivery of services, and that could mean products or services. So you know, everybody has heard of Netflix or Disney movies, and also the idea of working from home and using remote-based software systems that allow conferencing facilities to be used for conferencing with on business meetings or friends, family. So that there's all kinds of development happening there. So I suppose we can say, I mean, these are opportunities for not only investing in those areas as the new normal economy comes out, that this vision, but also in the sense of, you know, where the jobs are, where the jobs could be for the future. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think just picking up your topic of delivery of local grown food, we've already seen a lot of articles coming out about small farmers who were, you know, fairly close to cities, who were struggling to survive, are now seeing this kind of a boom where the services that have been around for decades, which is kind of a farm to table CSA kind of thing, where you know, small farms would deliver a box of the vegetables to, you know, the doorstep, right? And many of us have tried that over the years. And so what you're describing could be extremely good for relocalizing food and perhaps creating a delivery service that's not dependent on Amazon. You know, and competition is of course essential if you're going to have a vibrant economy. And so it'd be really nice if the business opportunities and job opportunities were in relocalizing industry, food prep, and then having those businesses deliver through the gig economy or their own employees. And that could definitely be a growth sector, which would be positive for the planet, because you're not burning jet fuel, flying, you know, grapes 6,000 miles and, you know, a lot of things that really don't make environmental or ecological sense, even if they made financial sense. So in terms of like lowering our carbon footprint and all that good stuff and creating local jobs, then this relocalizing the economy to serve the home body economy, that could be a source of great opportunities.
Yeah, I think, we can end on that discussion in relating back to two of your books, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, and also Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. If you can elaborate how your vision is for a local, more decentralized economy, and that applies to what you just referenced, you know, for farming, agriculture, but it could be also for education, child daycare services, everything. What are your final thoughts on that from your books?
Yeah, well, thank you for that intro. I think it, kind of in general, we've seen over the post-war era, going back 75 years and certainly the last 20 years, where profitability was dependent on scaling up really fast and reaching like national or global levels. What we're talking about now is a reversal of that centralization to a decentralized. And of course, this also makes sense in terms of like social distancing, and also more adept and more adaptive. Higher productivity comes from being flexible and adaptable, and that, of course, goes with having small work groups as opposed to some top-down centralized organization. And the universities are a good example of that, that people are starting to wake up to the fact that these sort of factories for education that constant, you know, put 20, 30,000 people in very small spaces are probably not going to work. And they weren't really that effective anyway, because many studies have found, you know, that 40% of the college graduates learned essentially nothing. And employers have discovered that they've learned nothing. So I think we could do a lot better by relocalizing education and putting the students right in the workplace, you know, and it's sort of an apprentice model, which, you know, is common in the trades, but it can be just as effective in management, you know, marketing, filmmaking, on and on and on. Everybody learns so much more in the workplace doing the work and then learning, you know, remotely in the evening or, you know, before work. So I think if we're going to look for an economy that has the traits that we want and value, which would be adaptive, flexible, innovative, competitive, creating opportunities and jobs, then that's a decentralized, relocalized economy is really the way to go.
Well, great insight, and we'll end on that positive vision. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com, and you can download free samples of all my books, and I welcome your visit.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.